The U.S. deploys more forces to the Mideast to deter Iranian threats to commercial vessels. Will it make a difference? We ask the Heritage Foundation.
My experience with Iran is they tend to be bullies. If you don't stand up to them, they'll keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And if you do stand up to them, they tend to back down.
Plus, a UN special rapporteur on human rights says only states have the real power to pressure Iran to stop persecuting women. A U.S.-based activist gives us his idea for what governments can do.
What I would say is needed is for member states of the UN to call out on them, dictatorial regimes, and just call them for what they are.
And a contributor to The Guardian tells us how she communicated with women in Iran facing university suspension for defying the mandatory hijab. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. The Biden administration made two announcements of military deployments to the Middle East last week, marking a shift in its tactics for confronting Iran's increasingly aggressive behavior toward commercial shipping in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Department said Thursday it was sending two amphibious warships and several thousand Marines to the U.S. military's Central Command, or CENTCOM, area of responsibility that covers the Middle East. That news came 3 days after the Pentagon said it was deploying a destroyer ship and F-35 fighter jets to the region. CENTCOM Commander General Michael Eric Carrilla said the U.S. will use the additional forces to further safeguard the free flow of international commerce, uphold the rules-based international order, and deter Iranian destabilizing activities in the region. Iranian forces seized two oil tankers in the area in April and May and tried to seize two others in early July, opening fire on one of them. Victoria Coates is a former U.S. national security official who served in the Trump administration and is now an analyst for the Heritage Foundation. I asked her by phone why the Biden administration is focused on military deterrence after its initial emphasis on diplomacy with Iran.
Well, I think it's because the regime in Tehran remains the same regime it has been since 79, and the Islamic Revolution, which has been resolutely hostile to the United States and our allies, first and foremost Israel, and very eager to resort to military action to express that hostility. And when the Biden administration came in, it was apparently their position that Iran could be engaged diplomatically to hopefully, from their perspective, get into a second version of the Obama-era nuclear deal. And so they have spent their time over the course of the last 2.5 years, you know, attempting this rapprochement through kind of shuttle diplomacy in Vienna, because to start with, the Iranians refused to meet directly with American counterparts. So whatever engagement took place through the auspices of the Russian envoy to this process. And then, meanwhile, the administration did things like take the Houthi, the Iranian proxies in Yemen, off the foreign terrorist organization list and stop enforcing sanctions with the intensity that the Trump administration had. And in response, the Houthi ramped up terrorist attacks and Iran continued their basically piracy in the Persian Gulf, attacking commercial shipping also in the Red Sea. And it has gotten to the point that even the Biden administration feels they have to do something about it and start to deploy additional resources back into the Gulf.
Well, how effective do you think these deployments announced last week are going to be?
Well, it depends on what their mandate and their orders are. You know, there is a lot of work to be done with partners and allies who are very frustrated by the lax approach that this administration has taken so far to violations by Iran of the normal laws of shipping and their willingness to attack civilian vessels. So we have frustrated partners in the region who are basically saying, you know, any other country that has done what Iran has done over the last couple of years in terms of maritime provocations would have gotten a much stronger response. Instead, they've gotten a very permissive response, so they've continued. So if these deployments have the latitude to actually counter Iran's actions and push back on them, I found in my experience with Iran is they tend to be bullies. If you don't stand up to them, they'll keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And if you do stand up to them, they tend to back down.
Well, speaking of standing up, the administration probably would say that they have been responding just to the recent incidents in early July of Iranian forces attempting to seize some commercial vessels in the Persian Gulf region. U.S. military assets were deployed and seemed to scare off the Iranian naval forces. What do you think of that kind of action that the administration has taken so far?
I was amazed that they took that action. And I think that certainly set the stage for the announcements this week. And, you know, nothing would make me happier than if they have decided that the national security of the United States and our partners and allies in the region requires a robust U.S. presence projecting strength in the Gulf. And, you know, that this was something they were pivoting away from. You know, the president, as a candidate for the presidency, famously called one of our most important allies of some 80 years in the region, Saudi Arabia, a pariah in a public debate. So there's a lot of ground for them to make up vis-a-vis the Iranian threat.
The latest deployments are supposed to deter what the Defense Department calls Iran's destabilizing activities. So they haven't said specifically we're trying to get Iran to stop harassing vessels, but they're kind of making this general statement of mission. What kinds of destabilizing activities do you think will be deterred by having more U.S. fighter jets and military vessels in that region?
Well, it's a long list. You start with their terrorist proxies, including the Houthi, who threaten shipping in the Red Sea. You have their terrorist proxies in Iraq. You have their terrorist proxies in Lebanon, in Syria. So their destabilizing activities go well beyond the Persian Gulf. But of course, what makes the Persian Gulf critical to the well-being of the United States is the flow of energy that comes out of the Strait of Hormuz, a tiny, thin little bottleneck through which a huge amount of the world's energy flows. Now, the good news there is we don't require that as imports anymore to the United States. We import a just de minimis amount of oil from the region as part of the commerce of the international energy markets. But if that is taken offline, and given the Biden administration's really quite draconian regulatory burdens on our own domestic energy production, the kind of surge that we were able to do in 2019 when the Iranians attacked Abqaiq in Saudi Arabia and brought Saudi Arabia's refining capacity offline for a period of time, you know, we were able to help with that. We wouldn't be able to now. I mean, our natural gas exports are stretched beyond their limits to try to support European partners in the lights of the Ukraine war, and we are also very stretched in terms of oil. So, you know, the ability we've had to buffer ourselves against disruptions in the Gulf is not what it was. And so, you know, one would hope that that's what these new deployments are focusing on.
Another thing I wanted to ask you is about the potential risk of a military confrontation when you have the U.S. very publicly beefing up its military forces in the region. What do you think might happen?
You know, it's always a concern, but bear in mind, this has been going on since the Reagan administration and Operation Praying Mantis in the 80s. So there have been various encounters between U.S. Navy assets and the Iranian Navy through the years, and the Iranians have never pushed this to the point that they're going to get serious attention from the U.S. Navy. So, you know, I think probably the closest we came was the incident of their seizing the boat with the U.S. service men and women.
Yes, that was in 2016.
That was a pretty serious incident, and had any of those individuals been harmed, I think we could have seen an escalation. But they've stopped short of that until now. So I wouldn't let fears of Iranian escalation deter me from following the best advice of my military commanders that said, when you put lots more material and people into what's frequently referred to in the region as the bathtub, you know, you do run a risk of unintended accidents and then escalation.
Something to keep an eye on. Victoria Coates, Senior Research Fellow for International Affairs and National Security at the Heritage Foundation, speaking to us on the line from here in Washington, D.C. Glad to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights Situation in Iran, Javaid Rehman, has called on member states of the world body to do more to hold Iran accountable for its poor human rights record and treatment of women and girls. Rehman made the appeal in a July 20th online presentation to an event hosted by the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based research institute. He said international action is needed, particularly in light of Iran putting its morality police back on the streets last week after they triggered months of nationwide protests last year for aggressive enforcement of the mandatory hijab.
Now, it is very disturbing for us to notice that Iran, the Iranian regime, has put in place or is putting in place further restrictions, further violations of the rights of girls and women through policies of enforced hijab, but also what I just mentioned, a scheme of gender apartheid. So let us reach out to member states, let us reach out to the international community, and together we work to engage with the international community so that there is enough pressure on the Iranian regime not to violate and degrade the rights of girls and women.
Rehman said he understood the frustration of rights activists who feel the UN's progress in responding to Iran's situation is too slow.
I think what we need to understand is that international law or international affairs are run by states. So we must work within that system. We must work through the Human Rights Council, which is the key body, which has that power, which can hold states to account. There are mechanisms which we can make greater use of. I mean, obviously, my mandate, the fact-finding mission, but the UPR is coming up. The next UPR is coming up, a Universal Periodic Review of Iran. Then individual states can also exert more pressure on Iran. And therefore, I would recommend very strongly that together with my mandate, with the civil society, I think we can work within the ambit of international law to ensure that the rights and dignity of the people of Iran are respected.
One of the activists who spoke at the event is Shaheen Malani, executive director of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, a U.S. nonprofit group. I was there, and I sat down with Malani to ask what he thought of Rehman's plea for action by UN member states.
Well, you know, within the UN system, there's so much that can be done. Even if the UN, they kicked Iran out of any UN bodies or places in which Iran has any leadership position, even if they denied those to Iran, still it wouldn't change the situation on the ground. You know, you have these isolated regimes like the Syrian government or North Korea, I would say they're more isolated than the Islamic Republic, but they're still in place, they're still killing people.
So what do you think would make a difference?
As I've always said, you know, we need a new regime in Iran. We need the establishment of a secular democratic government in Iran. And that is something that the Iran people have to do. What I would say the international community can do is to not shy away from saying that democracy is a fundamental human right, it's a universal right. And to treat democracy as a right the way they do, you know, with freedom of expression or religious freedom. A lot of people might not know this, but under Article 25 of the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, having free elections is a right. It's not a privilege that only people, you know, in rich Western countries have. It's a right guaranteed by international law to every person on the face of the planet. So what I would say is needed is for member states of the UN to call out on dictatorial regimes and just call them for what they are. In some sense, and it is the irony of being a human rights advocate, you know, we always call on Iran to respect its international obligations, and we call on the Iranian government to do that. But at the same time, the problem is that this government is illegitimate. So I think it would help if member states of the UN, UN mechanisms, would say that. I remember I was in Geneva a few months ago, and there is a, I forget his name, he's an American, he's a special rapporteur on Myanmar. And he, in his speech in the Human Rights Council, he explicitly called the Burmese government, the generals who were in charge, he called that regime illegitimate. And I like that. And I think that the same could be said about the Iranian government. And I would like to see the free word not mince words and say what the Iranian regime is. I think that would send a message to the Iranian people that the free world understands their plight and that the free world would support and would want to see a democratic Iran.
We'll have more of my conversation with Milani about the plight of Iran's religious and ethnic minorities in next week's show. British newspaper The Guardian is reporting that Iranian universities have suspended at least 60 female students for refusing to wear a hijab. In an article published July 10th, it said 9 suspended students spoke to the outlet about their fears for the future of their educational ambitions. Independent journalist Deepa Parent wrote the piece and spoke to the students. I asked her in a phone call how they reacted to her report.
So one response I've gotten is that a lot of them were a bit disappointed with the number that we stated in the article, because we had official number as 60 plus students. However, I've received a lot of messages from university students who told me.
They're saying, what about us, I guess?
Yeah. They also told me that there are friends of mine. Now, unless we have complete verification, it's impossible to do it when you're not on the ground. And we've told them that, no, I'm going to continue writing up your names in the list.
So you have a list that you're compiling?
Yes, yes. I have a human rights activist with whom I've been in touch with, and there is a list. Also, I've been speaking to human rights activists in Iran, HRA, and I've been also talking to them, cross-verifying with their list. So officially, the number is 60, 64. However, based on all the interviews, I know that the numbers are higher. But it's impossible to confirm how many more students have been suspended, because not everybody has been suspended for the same semesters. Some were suspended for the previous semester and then some of them the next one. So it's just impossible to collate the data from here. So we're just doing the best we can to bring this out in the open. And hopefully we will have a follow-up story where more and more girls come out and they tell us that they can share details of the suspensions with us, because I don't want to force anyone to give me a testimony, because it's a very risky situation.
You were speaking of the risks that these young women face. They also presumably face risks in communicating with you,
yes,
a journalist based in the West.
Yeah.
What can you share with our audience about, you know, how you communicate with these women and how challenging it is to maintain that communication?
So for the security, obviously, I cannot give out the mediums that I use. However, what I can say is that in many cases, I wait for them to get back to me and I don't send them messages and I don't hound them. I do not follow up with them until I hear from them. So sometimes they get back to me in a day. Sometimes they take a week. The internet is better. There haven't been disruptions as there were a few months ago, as we all noted. It's better than before. However, there's still risk because especially these students who have been suspended, they've been under watch and there are disciplinary committees which are, they're also checking their phones. Some of their phones were confiscated. So I do not want to put them in trouble. So we are following up on all the guidelines that are needed so that they are safe. So I'm making sure I do not message or call them unless they get back to me themselves.
I noticed that in your article, you didn't really specify the names of universities that were suspending these young women. Yeah. Can you tell us why that is? And can you actually name any of the universities?
So the thing is, the number of students suspended in every university is not large. It's in total in different cities and different universities. So in some universities, only 2 students were suspended. In some of them, only 3 were suspended. In some of them, 20. And one university which was out in the news was Tehran University of Arts. And they had a huge group of students who were in protest, and they were also violently dispersed. We've all seen the posts on social media, on Telegram, from the protest groups, from citizen journalists. So that's the only university that everybody was talking about. But the students I've interviewed, some of them have only been 2 or 3 of them. So I do not want to compromise their security by naming the university. It's going to be very obvious, and we don't want that.
It would be obvious to the administrators.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which of the 2 or 3 students spoke to a foreign journalist. What have these students said to you about their next moves? I read that they're fearful. They want to continue their studies, but they don't know what's going to happen. What have they told you?
So some few of the students actually are very interested in studying in Europe. And some of them have been making sure that they get good grades and everything is in line, all the papers, documents, all the grades. However, after what happened last September, after Mahsa Amini's death was reported and they all started protesting, the situation changed. And now they didn't expect that the university admins that they trusted to an extent would actually punish them for protesting. In many cases, the security personnel have been extremely violent with students who were peacefully protesting. And so in this case, the fact that they wanted to move to Europe and do their masters and different programs, they now fear that even the recommendation letters that they're supposed to get from the university will not come by and they won't be able to leave the country. And unfortunately, a lot of them do want to leave because they believe that a lot of the expectations they had from the movement, they're being stalled and they are hopeful, but they're more fearful that they don't have enough support.
So one question I have for you is, what alternative is there for these women to getting a recommendation letter from a university professor? Is there some other way they can get a referral?
Well, I've asked them about it. I asked them also that if you're applying from a university in Iran and you're writing a personal statement and you obviously are going to mention what you've done for the past 1 year, and she said yes. And one of them said that I am happy to mention it. However, we do not want to compromise our admission process abroad because if they think that we've been so somehow they think that if they tell the universities in Europe that we've been protesting, they won't pass the admission process and they won't get the admission abroad because they think that they're going to be called troublemakers. That really surprised me. I didn't write that, but that really surprised me.
It seems like they're in a catch-22 situation.
Exactly, exactly. That's the word. Because I really felt bad for them. They think that Europe won't accept them because they'll think they're troublemakers. And Iran, they're stuck there. That's what they think. But they also hope that, you know, they can stay back in their country. And they love their country. They want freedom. They want, many of them say that it's not a priority to move abroad. It's not that we want to move abroad and just settle out there, or maybe we want to come back home at some point. We want to meet our family. We want to also help contribute to the economy. But nothing is going to happen if you're stuck inside the country and situation is getting worse. And with morality police being reinstated, as they said, the situation is going to get worse is what they fear.
Well, I do hope that you can continue this great reporting and look forward to getting more great information from you in the future. Deepa Parent, independent journalist covering human rights for The Guardian, speaking to us from India. Nice to have you back on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you, Michael.
That's it for this week's program. You can subscribe to more episodes on Apple and Google Podcasts. If you're using the Apple app, please leave a review. I'm Michael Lippin. Thank you for listening.